So our next speaker, just to start to introduce Chris Cuff, when I was a little girl, my dad had a favourite saying, and he used to say, if you're not a socialist in your 20s, you don't have a heart. But if you have not turned capitalist by your 30s, you don't have a brain. And I think that what Chris has done, it looks like reading his CV, he's kind of inverted that. So Chris started out as an extremely successful and high octane kind of white line funds manager. He was the CEO of Colonial First State. He was the CEO of Challenger. Then around 2006, he moved into a whole different kind of array of roles, setting up Social Ventures Australia. And then at the moment, he's got a very significant portfolio of chairmanships and board roles, including, I should say, chairing UniSuper, which is an industry super fund, and Chris tells me is the only industry super fund whose defined benefit scheme is still open to new members. So if you're after a great pension, go and train as a uni lecturer quick. So that's fantastic. But more importantly, Chris has been involved in starting and establishing an enormous array of extremely important not-for-profit organisations across Australia. And so he's an incredible leader, both in the funds management industry, but also in the philanthropic industry. So it's fantastic he's able to join us today to talk about some of the journey that he's been on. So please give Chris Cuff a very warm round of applause.
Thank you, Naomi, and thank you for having me here today, although following Glenn McGrath is not going to be easy. I only accepted, by the way, because my son is a cricket tragic, and when I got an invite to come and speak, and Glenn McGrath was going to speak before you, I thought I'll be able to get a cricket ball signed, so I just got Glenn to sign a ball before. Anyhow, not really. I was a little nervous when I was asked to speak, but I did accept, and I was a little nervous because I'm an accountant by training. I'm a chartered accountant, and I know there's always a bit of a tussle between the actuaries and accountants for who's got the most personality. But I knew actuaries had the intellect, so I thought I should accept and come on down. I've actually had the pleasure of working with a number of actuaries over the years. And some of them touch the organisation I'm chairman of, UniSuper, one of our past CEOs, Ron Champion, who was a past president of your institute, and indeed the current CEO of UniSuper, Kevin O'Sullivan, is an actuary, so we love actuaries. I've had great dealings in my past too in the State Bank of New South Wales days with Jeff Walker, an actuary, and we then bumped into a very interesting man, Bob Pfeiffer, in the colonial days. Anyhow, it was great. I thought I would talk about the general topics, leadership, but I was really giving you a perspective of my particular journey and how I've tried to adapt it to achieve success, I guess, but success from my eyes. The world we live in today, you know, success is normally judged by the same old norms, you know, how much money you earned, how high you got in your career, how much power you have or prestige or whatever. And, you know, whilst that might come in parts of your career, the only person who's really going to be the right judge of you is you. So when you're there in a nursing home one day, dribbling, rocking in a chair, living up to longevity, you'll think about your life, and I think Glenn mentioned it too. You know, you've got to make it happen. It's not going to... you've got to go through the experiences. This is a great journey if you want to be on it. Most of you probably first heard of me in a blaze of publicity in 2003. I thought a quiet little lad looking after Colonial First State, and all of a sudden I was on every newspaper, the front page, and every TV channel, every radio station. I was mentioned in Parliament in a particular period of a week where I was known as the $33 million man. I apparently had some huge payout, and it was unbelievable time, unbelievable in a negative position. None of that was quite true. Aspects of it were, but the whole thing was blown out of proportion. It was a time in business when there had been a number of corporate rogues who'd been paid out large sums of money to leave their organisations. Some of those are still in jail. And I, for some reason, seemed to get mixed up in all that when all I had done, I thought, was help with a great team of people create an amazingly successful organisation, being Colonial First State. I was there right at the start, and during my 14-year tenure there, it went from having funds under management from zero to 70 billion. We had 500,000 investors by the end. We were making very significant profits. In fact, the time when I sort of got this unwanted publicity, I just started working for Kerry Packer at Challenger. And, you know, if things had been reversed, I probably wouldn't have gone there, because that's a fairly high-profile family. So if you'd suddenly got profile in the press, the worst thing you could do is go and get more profile and go and work for a Packer. But I do remember right at the start, I think Kerry was a little worried that I was going to renege, because I'd accepted to go there. Then I got this blaze of horrible publicity. And then I hadn't actually started, or actually I just started at CPH at Park Street headquarters. And anyhow, I guess Kerry must have sensed I was wavering a little, and he rang me, and he said, this is, I think, on the day the publicity storm broke, or the next morning, and he said in his normal gruff way, you know, "How's it going, son?" And I said, "I'd had better days, Kerry. In fact, I'd just had the press chase me to work in my car. I mean, he's me. I'm just a mere accountant. I'm not Glenn McGrath. I'm not the royal family or whatever." And then he gave one of those gentle motivational speeches he's famous for. He said, "Tell him to fuck off." He went on to say, "You made him $5 billion," which I thought, well, I said, "Thank you, Kerry, for that speech." Anyhow, I did keep going, but it was certainly a big turning point in my life, that whole thing. Not only the negative publicity for something that I thought, again, I'd done something good, but it was starting to ruin what was a fantastic chapter of my life. Working at Colonial First State, if any of you have ever had the opportunity to work in an organisation that's been there, and you've been there from the beginning, and it's become strong and you know, a leader in its field. You know, we went from a start-up to the largest fund manager in Australia in the space of 12 years. It was fantastic. I was very fortunate that during most of that period, except for the first 12 months, I was the CEO. I had a magnificent team around me. I learned so much about leadership. Obviously, I survived there a while, so I had to keep... when you're in a start-up and it gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and by the time I left, I think there were 1,500 staff. As a leader, you need to adapt. There's no doubt about it. But I learned a hell of a lot, and in particular, I learned things that I think hold me in good stead today, around passion and focus and trusting the staff around you and staying humble and the like. But anyhow, when I finished, I did honour and go to work for what became what was then Challenger as the CEO of the listed organisation that Packers owned a fair bit of. And after, I did sort of a few years there, but I always had at the back of my mind that it was time to move out of this area, this whole area of sort of 9-to-5, go commerce. And I guess in that sense it was a bit of a midlife crisis. I was 40-something years old, and I've always had in the back of my mind anyhow that life has really got a few phases to it. That's the way I saw it anyhow. I thought your first phase of life is really about learning, you know, from the day you're born to going through your various stages of school and university and then you're sort of learning the road in a new job. And then the second stage is probably earning. You know, you've got a mortgage, you've got kids, you've got everything that you need to do to keep going. The bills never stop. There's all that career earning, etc. But the third stage of life, I think, is the one where you really need to be true to yourself. You know, how do you really want to contribute? What do you want to do in your journey of life? And, you know, our life is so much in railway tracks. Again, I say to people, you know, you think from the time you're born, this so much is set in concrete. Again, you are going to go to to school, primary school, high school, you may go to university, you're going to have a mortgage, you're going to get a job, it's quite a railway track, and it's hard sometimes to have the, if you like, the freedom to think outside of that. Anyhow, when I finished at Challenger, I thought, no, look, I'm going to take a different track now, because success for me, as I was sort of alluding to at the start, success is what I'm going to be the judge of my success, not somebody else. And I wanted to see if I could turn my hand to other things. And in fact, I remember a period of 3 months between jobs where I sat down with a clean sheet of paper and basically thought, what do I want to do? Just what do I want to do? Now, I was clearly fortunate financially coming out of Colonial First State. That had been fantastic financially. So I had choices. But, you know, to have money in your pocket is one thing. But a clean sheet of paper about what you would do, and I challenge you, you know, go home and sort of sit out in the back veranda and look at the trees. Think about if you could do anything in life from this point on, what would you do? And after a lot of thinking, I thought, well, the thing I like most in life, actually, is to help people. Now, that's not particularly big revelation, you'd think, but whole books are written on that, and it takes a lot of people a long time to get it. The last book, which I really like on the whole subject, is by Hugh McKay, who's a sort of real fan of mine. He's a social commentator, social researcher. He's got his last book, The Good Life. I'd encourage you to read it. It's the best book I've read in my life about what matters and what makes you have satisfaction. But I really felt I really enjoy helping people. And I think if I have the resources and the time and the willingness, why don't I get on that? And I think I was fortunate too that I learnt from a very young age that happiness is really a product of the individual and how you engage with the world. And it's not a product of the environment you're in or materialism. You can try that path, but I think most of us know that's not really it. There's not a particularly strong link between economic prosperity and happiness past a certain level. Of course, if you don't have any economic earning ability at all, that can be hard. But the link between past a certain earning level or between happiness and prosperity is not there. I knew if I wanted to do different things, one of my early bosses said something to me that still rings in my ears. He said there's three types of people in life. There's people who make things happen, there's people who watch what happened, and there's people who wondered what happened. And I thought, well, I'm in the first category, and none of being in any one of these categories is not, there's no one better category than the other. I can tell you my wife, who's 100 times smarter than me, she hates making decisions. She's the person you pick first to be on your team, but don't make her the captain. She would freeze. So she likes to watch what happened, but she doesn't want to make things happen. I'm in the category, I was just born as one of those A types, can't sit still, always thinking. I drive people nuts who are around me. I'm always trying to think about how to make things better or some new idea. And so I knew what I was going to do in this next, if you like, my next road was I was going to want to make things, I wanted to be relevant, I wanted to make, do things of significance. I remember as a kid, as a quick aside, thinking about doing things differently. I also grew up in the country near Griffith in New South Wales, and you wouldn't know it, but I am 54. When my first tooth fell out, it was threepence time. So I took my tooth, and we lived in this old mansion, and it was. I put a jar on the mantelpiece with a tooth in it, and lo and behold, next morning got up, and there was threepence there. I thought, great. And then I thought about this for a while, and light bulb went on. I went out to Dad's workshop, way out the back, the tool shed, and I got a big ball hammer. And we had an old butchery from years ago on our farm. There's a lot of sheep skulls. So I got a huge jar, knocked all these teeth out of these sheep skulls, filled the jar up. It was one of those big old, you preserve fruit. And I had the thing right to the top, and I brought it in when Mum wasn't around, Dad wasn't around, put it on the thing that night. I thought, I've got it. I got a note the next morning that it doesn't quite work that way, and the tooth fairy's smart enough to work out a human tooth from a lamb's tooth. At the time, my younger brother straight away said, Mum, Mum, he might take my teeth out. Anyhow, getting on to the current. So when I moved out of Challenger, a few months off, thinking about what I wanted to do and really where my next track in life was, and I joined an organisation called Social Ventures Australia, which was a not-for-profit organisation, and they were really populated by largely business people who were trying to work with the non-for-profit sector to bring, if you like, business disciplines to the way non-profits are run. And that can be, that might sound, when I say it quick enough, a little bit biased. I mean, not all non-profits are run poorly, but I've worked in that sector in one form or another for many years now, and there's no doubt that the disciplines are a little bit different to what you probably have in business. And that's understandable in some ways, because the output of business is normally measured in dollars, you know, profits, return on equity, whatever. Outputs for non-profits are quite different to that. You can't always measure them easily. And so it tends to be that the sort of disciplines around reaching that thing are very different. But we found we could bring business disciplines to help improve non-profits. In 2006, so I worked for Social Ventures Australia. I came on there full time, 4 days a week. I say 4 days a week because one of the things I did decide back then, it was a really selfish thing, but I've kept it to this day, that I wanted to spend a day a week with my wife. So we in this fast track life were all in, you know, I had four kids now. You know, you spend your week at work, working your ass off, and you get the weekend, and it's kids stuff, and you've got no time often you don't have time just for yourself or with your partner. So I thought after I left Challenger, if I could do it, I would take a day off a week, which is Mondays, which I have to this date, and just spend it partly on me and partly on my wife. So we just have our time, which has been fantastic for our relationship. Again, very fortunate we can do it, and I would always say to anybody in all the activities that I do, I don't think that gets in the way of my productivity. Like most of you in the room, by the very nature of your occupation, I bet you just don't switch your mind off at 5 o'clock or at on Friday afternoon. So you just sort of keep going. That was a great experience for me. During the time at Social Ventures Australia, I had a sort of light bulb moment again. It wasn't quite about taking teeth out of sheep's skulls, but I decided, because I'd come from the investment management industry and a lot of people knew me, I thought I'll start up an investment management fund, which exists to this day. It's now nearly 6 years old. It's called Third Link Growth Fund. I thought I'll start this fund up, and the management fees I receive from managing the fund, I'll give to the charitable sector. And I thought that would be a pretty neat way to sort of use my investment skills and help the charitable sector. But of course, if hopefully actuaries understand profit equals revenue minus expenses, so I knew if I was to start a fund up, it was never going to be huge. I'm not an institution. So the revenue less the expenses, the profit from running a single fund of sub 100 million was not going to be much at all. I mean, these days, if you're a fund manager, you need sort of $1 billion just to pass go to make money on it. So what I decided to do, I'd run it as a fund of funds. That is, so it's an Australian equity fund. It's a fund of funds. I get other managers to actually manage the money through their existing funds. And I convinced all those at the time to refund all their performance fees and management fees. So they're effectively doing it for nothing. So if you like, I've got the revenue off the fund, I've got almost no expenses, and so the profit is almost the same as the revenue, and it's quite significant. That fund has been going now, I mentioned before, nearly 6 years. It's got about $70 million in it. That fund, I now give away just on $80,000 per month from that fund to half a dozen charities. It's been incredible. For me, it was an interesting way to try, how can I use the investment industry to try and get money to the not-for-profit industry without anybody hurting? So the investors in my fund get all the normal returns an investor in a managed fund would get. They're not making any donation. It's just the management fees are going to charity, and that is really because of the generosity of the fund managers doing it all for free, and then all the service providers. So I have groups like RBC, who are doing RBC Investment Services, who are doing the custodianship and the fund accounting, and I've got Ernst & Young doing tax returns, and Deloitte's doing this, and Minter Ellison doing the legals, etc. There's probably 20 or 30 different parties in the finance industry doing something for free on this, and it's really enjoyable. It doesn't take a lot of my time anymore. I've obviously got to pick the right managers and the like, but it works pretty much on automatic pilot, and a nice earning stream that comes off the back of it. In fact, when it gets to its full potential, which I think is about 150 million in size, that I'll close it, that will be giving away just on $200,000 a month to the charitable sector, which will make, which will place it in the top 10 givers in Australia. But I thought that was just an interesting way to be a bit entrepreneurial in the philanthropic sector. A few years ago, I also had a sort of idea. Our family started something called a private ancillary fund. Now, I'm sure you all know about that, and for those who don't, you'll run home and Google it. Private ancillary funds, in essence, are charitable trusts that you can run as a family. You set the trust up, you get a tax deduction for all the money you put in the thing, and then the trust must give away a certain amount each year to charity, a minimum of 5%. These are pretty good vehicles, these private ancillary funds. Our family set one up in 2006. We've had a lot of enjoyment out of running the thing. But as the years, when we set it up, it was, I didn't know anything about it. There was hardly any professional advisors around on it. It was clunky to do. It was expensive to set up. And a couple of years after seeing it set up, I thought, this isn't that hard to run, really, or to understand how they work. But nobody was doing it. So I thought I'd set up a company which now exists called Australian Philanthropic Services. That's a charity. And we just specialise in setting up these trusts for families. We also help families with grant-making advice. So if you want to give money away, which you've got to give money away through these trusts, we're one of the few groups who can actually help advise you on how the charitable sector works, or we can do due diligence on charities or whatever. But setting a business up that was a charity that specialised in just setting up private ancillary funds and public ancillary funds and administering them has turned out to be a pretty good community service. And it is a community service. As I say, Australian Philanthropic Services is a charity. All I wanted to do in that charity to make it sustainable, which is one of my real passions, to see charities sustainable, we wanted to charge people a nominal fee for setting these things up and running them, which we do, and I knew once we had enough clients we'd be break even and we'd stay that way forever. And I made sure in setting the thing up that I had a few strong personalities on the board. So the well-known company director, David Gonski, I worked on him for 2 years to get him to join the board. He finally said yes, so he's on the board. I'm chairman of it. We've got people like Tim Fairfax, a well-known philanthropist, Belinda Hutchinson, the chair of QBE, or just retiring as chair, and the Chancellor of Sydney University, Jan Swinhoe, one of your crew and actuary, and the like. And so this thing's gone really well, but it was a really great thing for me to get involved with. I love doing these days. That thing now has 80 to 90 clients who I think are all very satisfied, and it's been a great community service. Another that I recently got involved with was watching the sort of poor state of financial journalism in this country, because the business models for journalism were falling apart, as you all know, with the internet and the like. Myself and a few others decided we'd start a weekly finance newsletter called Cufflinks. We spent a long time working out that name. I didn't want the name, by the way, but anyhow, we ended up having it. That thing has gone fantastic. We do it for love again, not for profit. It's now got about 6,000 subscribers. The key with that newsletter and the way we're running it was to say, look, we want 5 articles a week, 1,000 words each, and that would go out on a Friday. That was the sort of formula. 1,000 words is not a lot, so whatever was written had to be short, sharp, succinct, because we're all short of time, and I wanted to make sure that 1,000 words articles were written by experts from the industry, so not journalists. So I got my black book out, rung everybody I could think of to say, you'd be good at contributing to Cufflinks. I'll put you down for 4 articles a year, you're up for 2, you're up for 3. And away we went, and we've got this newsletter that's worked fantastically. I was very pleased with that actually. It sort of shows in the years gone past being brandished in the press, it actually can help you if you turn it the right way. Glenn's famous for being a great cricketer. He probably hasn't had anything negative, but my negativity in the press over time turned around because people I think figured out I didn't do anything wrong, and it opened a lot of doors. My first three articles for Cufflinks I managed to get Paul Keating to write, which I thought was pretty impressive. The last of the things I've done on my journey so far is very recently got involved with a group called Primary Ethics. So if your kids go to a New South Wales primary school, they've got a choice. They for 1 hour a week they can go to religious classes, but for nearly a quarter of the kids in the state, they choose not to go to religious classes for whatever reason. Either they're not religious, or their family wants someone else teaching the religion, or their brand of religion is not taught at their school, whatever. So those kids sit outside and do nothing. The laws of the state said they weren't allowed to be taught anything else. So myself and a few others were involved in a group called Primary Ethics, which now supply, with the change of Act of Parliament, we had to get an Act of Parliament changed in the New South Wales Parliament that now allows kids in New South Wales who don't want to go to religious classes, they have the option of being taught ethics classes by qualified volunteers. So I'm chairman of a trust, part of that charity, trying to raise $10 million to keep that thing going in perpetuity. The trouble with a lot of charities, as I've worked out, you know, it's a sort of rat in a cage existence for many CEOs. They're always trying to raise money and it's always running out. You know, I'm very much from the world of capital pools. I like capital pools. That's why I like ThirdLink. What it does is a pool of capital that's growing. The pools of capital, little foundations established through Australian Philanthropic Services, Primary Ethics, Future Trust, raising money there, invested forever. The income stream comes off that to support it. To me, annuity streams are just so important for charities. I think as a kid, my grandfather used to always say to me the importance of getting a strong tree and the fruit will come off year after year. You know, and whatever you do, just get something that can produce. So I hope I've given you a little bit of a smattering there of how things I've done to adapt my skills. I'm certainly very involved in the investment industry still. I love my role as chairman of UniSuper. I love receiving the actuaries report each year on the health of the defined benefit scheme. That's sort of reading like the next novel you can't wait to get. And I've learnt in my journey so far, I think of things as the reality is that you live your life to new ways of thinking. So you live it through experiences that might change the way you think about things, rather than think your life to new ways of living. So you can't do life from your desk or your lounge. You know, get out there, try different things, experience different things wherever they are, and steer your own course, not what others might expect of you. You know, believe me, once you get to about 50, I found anyhow that I truly do start to think of life as being more of a defined amount of time. Now that, of course, is obvious. Life's a defined amount of time, but you know we all know when you're a young kid or a teenager, 20s, 30s, you don't think about that. But to turn sort of around 50 or thereabouts, you start to think about, oh, gee, you know, I probably do have limited time on this earth. What are you going to do with it? And that's not in a morbid sense. That's in a very positive sense. You know, what could you do? How could you explore your other abilities and the like? The final thing I wanted to, because I know I'm about to be beeped. Glenn crowded me out by 4 minutes, by the way, but I'll be a team player. That's okay. I'll get us back on time. As a final note, I'm sure some of you have heard this, but I read a fantastic little thing on what success is some time ago in the paper, so I'll just quote it. So this is the perspective of what success is, which I've tried to sort of give a flavour of that in my talk. At age 4, success is not piddling in your pants. At age 12 is... At age 12, success is having friends. At age 17, success is having a driver's licence. At age 35, success is having money. At age 50, success is still having money. At age 70, success is having a driver's licence. At age 75, success is having friends. And at age 80, success is not piddling in your pants. Thank you.
Thanks, Chris. We're going to have some questions now, so this is your opportunity, and hopefully you'll see the SMS number on the text. Both speakers have said that they're happy to answer questions about absolutely anything and everything. So this is a once-in-a-lifetime chance. It doesn't just have to be about leadership, because I think both of the gentlemen have just taken us on a bit of a journey through their personal lives and the various changes that they've made. So we'd be very interested for people to text through some questions to us or come up to the microphone. Chris, I just had a question. I mean, my dad said, you know, you should be a socialist first and a capitalist later. If you could replay your life, would you do it in a different order or...?
Well, I'm glad you didn't start off in your intro, by the way, saying I was the narcissist side of the plenary session here. No, look, as human beings, it's... You know, you get some... What happens in your early years is very important. I was really lucky, I think, in my... what I call my most formative years, I was brought up in the country. And, you know, country people have got... are they different city people? I don't know. They've got different circumstances. But I found a lot of the way I think about life and what matters and what doesn't probably came from those experiences, as well as how I think about the outdoors versus the indoors, and just people in general. So I was very fortunate, I think, with an upbringing in an environment that was fantastic, that made me think from an early age about the importance of everybody's lot in life. No one person's more important than another, and helping people is what a community is all about. I mean, the difference between, really, I think, a prosperous society and a great society is really what happens in the social sector, the wider social sector, arts, sports, looking after people around you and the like. So, I think having that sort of grounding first helped me. I mean, there's no doubt if you've had a successful business career in the sense of earning money that puts you in good stead, then that if you've got that sort of feeling underneath of wanting to help people, you can do marvellous things. You know, money's just a medium of exchange. Use it to do whatever you can that gives you a buzz.
Thanks. Now, do we have any people who want to come up? We actually do have heaps of room at the microphones for questions, so just feel free to go and walk to the mic there in the middle of the room. I've got a... Glenn, we just had an interesting question. How important was the culture of nicknames to building team spirit? And I think it's a serious question.
Well, I think it's the Australian way. Everyone has to have a nickname, don't they? When I first moved to Sydney, playing for Sutherland, I didn't have a nickname. And I went to training one day and they settled on one of two nicknames depending on what caravan I lived in. So it was either Millard or Viscount. And I lived in a Millard, so that was my nickname from then on. When I made the Australian New South Wales team, actually Brad McNamara, who's a stalwart for New South Wales, was walking around one day during a Shield match saying there was a pigeon out there that couldn't land. And nobody knew what a pigeon was. And, knew what he was talking about, sorry, and they asked him, and he said because he felt I had stolen the pigeon's legs. Because my legs were quite skinny, so a stupid comment like that. And, my nickname now is Pigeon or Pidge, and it's stuck ever since. So I think it's good in a team environment. Everyone has their own nicknames. It's a way to, to really become mates. You don't call someone by their nickname unless you're a mate. And to bring the team together and be really close and that camaraderie, that mateship, I think is what really... holds us together. It's what held the Australian team together. And you look at that Australian team, there's some pretty big personalities. But to bring them all together for the same common goal and really work together was a pretty big thing where egos didn't get in the way too much. Warnie was a little different. Warnie was here, the rest of the team was here. The rest of the team were happy with that. Warnie was happy with that, so it was a win-win situation. So I do think nicknames are important just to bring that closeness, that mateship and sort of that same common goal together.
And we've got a question on the screen here that someone's texted about the role of mentors. As a leader, how important is it to find another strong leader who can be a mentor to you? And did either of you have someone who took that role for you?
The term mentor I struggle to touch with in the formality of it. So some people might go out and seek a person to be a mentor to them, and I tend to find that certainly for me, I didn't have a mentor, a person who I'd earmarked either by telling them or just or not telling them, but more you learn the characteristics of other people. So I've found I didn't have one particular, but there would be three or four people in my career who I would say made an enormous impact. They mightn't have known it, and they probably don't know it to this day. So watching other people. I think when you are in a position of leadership, as given that this is the topic, never underestimate there's others watching you and hopefully, you know, learning off you for the good as well. But no, in a couple of those, the main things I learnt was probably about humility. You know, one of the most important things was really, you know, let's face it, everybody in this room, you're pretty lucky. You're born with a certain IQ. You probably came born in a reasonable postcode. I'm not saying that's everything. This is an on average, actually. On average, you're well off in the way you came into this world, and you're in a good profession and all that. Now, a lot of people aren't born that way. They're not necessarily born with a high IQ, or they're in the wrong postcode or whatever. And so, you know, are you better than them just because you were born that way? And so early people that meant a lot to me have sort of shown that understanding early.
Glenn, have you had a mentor?
I wouldn't say there was one mentor. I agree a little bit with Chris here. I think, if I take the Australian cricket team, the senior players were in a position where the young guys had come in the team, and, you know, you try to make the young guys feel as comfortable as possible straight away so they relax and they can just go out there and perform without any of the pressures of what's happening around them. They can bounce things off the senior players, be there to chat, but I agree. You know, it's about watching what the other guys do and then getting out there and doing it yourself. You know, they say experience is something you can't buy on a shelf, nor should you be able to, and I'm a big fan of that. So get out there and have a go. Watch how other people do it. Learn from that. Learn from your mistakes. I mentioned before, I don't think a mistake's a mistake unless you make it over and over again. And the way to learn, if you did everything perfectly from day one, you wouldn't learn a thing. So that was it, just getting out there, experiencing things. And I think in a very lucky position where we also got to travel and see how other people live, how other cultures live. And I'm a big fan, one for, I think all teenagers in Australia should go and spend a bit of time in India. A month or two over there, I think they'd come back with a different appreciation on life. So I think it's just about experiences, watching how people go about it and then learning, and then work out what works for you. You know, what works for one person not going to work for others. And I just think you always look to improve. If someone gives you a bit of advice, I'm happy to go out there and try it. If it works, great. If it doesn't, okay, I know, move on. And it's just about life experiences and looking to improve all the time. So I've had a few, I wouldn't say mentors, there's a couple of important people in my life. Steve Rickson, who I mentioned, was one of the reasons I moved to Sydney. He was the coach of the New South Wales team when I first started, and the work ethic he had in that role had a big effect on me. So just watching how other people go about it and sort of having that respect for them and respect for your teammates helped me in good stead too.
We've got a question here. If you're leading a team and the team are not actually performing well, they're not high calibre people perhaps, for you as a leader, what's the best way to kind of start to work with that team to set a course for improvement?
Well, I think, you know, if I take the scenario as the cricket team, we'd sit down and have team meetings and go through plans. And there was three sections I cut my playing career into. on a daily basis or week or whatever. One was preparation, one was execution, one was analysis. So you go there, prepare, and that's team meetings, in the nets, in the gym, doing everything to prepare yourself for what you're going into, for my circumstance was into a game situation. Then it's about execution, how you perform, how you put those plans in place. And then afterwards, it's about, okay, let's sit down and work out what worked, what didn't work, were the plans right, did we execute well, and go through. And then you learn from that, and then the cycle starts again. So it's basically going through that. You sit down and analyse what went wrong, why it went wrong, and then put in a plan next time to overcome that. So it's a bit of a learning process. So
I knew that cricketers and actuaries have a lot in common because, of course, actuaries have something we call the control cycle, which is basically set an assumption, review it, analyse the variance, and keep refining. So,
I'd say for me, probably in business, it's depended more about whether you're creating a team from scratch or you're sort of parachuted into an existing team as a leader, and the way you go. But I certainly was very strong on changing people if it wasn't working. If a team was not working, and the amount of time you had to change was a variable depending on, you know, the situation you're in. But generally speaking, I never hesitate in changing people in the team. And sometimes that comes out in the nasty word of firing. I tend to find in most teams I've been in that often when I was in Colonial First State, it was very interesting because I said we went from a start-up to a very big fund manager, the biggest in Australia. So did I have the same management team throughout? And no, I didn't. There were some people who were superb in the early stages, which didn't work out as we got to a different stage. And others did adapt. They reinvented themselves at the same pace, which I guess in essence is what I had to do as a long CEO there. The big thing, I mean, it's very stock standard out of a management textbook, but often I find people are in the wrong position. You know, I see people in their careers and that you're promoted to a certain degree, and then for many people they're promoted one or two past where they should be. And they haven't had the understanding to call it at that stage and say, no, I don't want the next promotion, or their boss has been too naive. I mean, often with technocrats in particular, they can get promoted into positions of management way too early, or, you know, or they just don't fit there. And that sometimes comes out, you find in your team you've got people who are great technically, but as an organisation gets bigger, you know, things like management technical skill becomes less amongst the people at the top, and governance and culture and how you get the best out of people, that's the skill set that is needed more.
Great. And just one specific question we've had for you, Chris. You say you work basically part-time now. Do you think for people in financial services today, particularly for younger people, can you still succeed in your career if you work part-time?
Yeah.
Do you think we've really made that transition, or you think it's a stigma too?
Well, first of all, I'd say I don't work part-time. It's just that I work disjointed hours. I'm being pedantic there. Sorry, I'm sitting forward because I appreciate the people on my left can't quite see. It's very difficult. So to start with, I think, you know, if you were to say, look, everybody should work, 4 days a week instead of five or whatever part-time, I think it's a little unrealistic. I think you go through your career, and there's no doubt in the early years you need to work hard and you need to work a full week and the like. What I would encourage people to challenge themselves on, though, as they get older and further into their career, is there a possibility to work less in the business with a trade-off? So, for example, you know, financial services industry is a very well-paid industry, as we know, and there's many people have a chance at a year-end bonus, for example. I mean, why wouldn't you at a certain age say, look, I don't want the bonus or the pay rise. Instead, could I have a day a fortnight instead? And if at that stage you can guarantee to the boss that you still get your job done, well, everybody's a winner. I mean, crazy if you don't do it, I reckon, unless you've got nothing else that turns you on in life that you want to do. So I think it's possible, but let's not be unrealistic. Tougher earlier in your career to be the part-timer.
Great. And we've got time for one final question. If there's no one in the audience, we'll go to the screen. Both of you have clearly made a lot of time to reflect on your careers and think about what matters and what doesn't. And I guess the question is, do you make specific time for reflection in an incredibly busy day when, you know, we're all A-type people or, you know, white line fever? How do you actually build in that time to reflect when there's so much pressure on what needs to be done each day? Glenn, I don't know.
I think it's a work in progress, really. I don't set aside time to reflect. It's just as you go through life and then you sort of think back on what happened and reflect. You know, I do view myself a very lucky person. You know, the things I've got to do, the places I've been, the people I've seen, people I've met, even down to my family, and meeting Jane and now being lucky enough to meet Sarah. But there's been challenges in my life. There's been some very tough times when Jane was going through through her journey, and then when she passed away was one of the toughest times in my life. But I just think everyone's got their own battles and challenges to face, and it's how you pick yourself up afterwards and continue on. So I think reflection is an ongoing process. I guess similar to Chris, I'm born and bred in the country. So I grew up with the idea of treating people the way I want to be treated. That still doesn't mean as soon as I walked on the cricket field, I knew exactly what I wanted to achieve, and I wasn't going to, you know, make it easy for the other person. But it's, I think, off the field, real life, just treat people the way you want to be treated. I think I don't do anything differently to anyone else in the same situation. Fair enough, there's been tough times, but I just enjoy it. And I think sometimes going through something like what I went through and what we went through with Jane, it sort of puts life in perspective. And all the things you used to worry about, you know, if you found out tomorrow that you only had 6 months to live, the things you worried about today would be totally irrelevant. And that's sort of a way I just sort of, I sort of think that to myself every now and then, just to put life in perspective. And it's, to me, it's the people in your life and that are probably more important than anything else, your friends, your family. And so, I guess life in itself, just living it and experiencing it, you'll reflect on that, and then you grow as a person, and off you go.
Thanks. Did you want to add anything?
Yeah, look, I think, like Glenn, it's always a work in progress. You know, people talk about balance of life. Sort of balance of life, I find, is a difficult concept because different people are wired in different ways. You know, one of the things, I try very hard these days to think about work, although I don't call it work. I do things that I want to do, but let's call that work. And then there's community type stuff, there's clearly family type stuff, and there's me type stuff. And the me type stuff is important. I've worked that out over time, that it's really important to take time out for yourself, both whether it's, you know, do exercise or, you know, whatever, but not only look after the body, but try and look after the mind too. You know, what's your belief system? What shapes your belief? What are you reading these days? Who do you talk to? Why? And maybe I think too much about it, but that's important. I found on the other side during my career, and this has shaped what I did later in life, when I was involved in a full-time role, be it at Colonial or indeed Challenger, my type of personality was probably unfortunate to live with, in that I got so focused on what I was doing, like really focused. People used to say, if you use one adjective to describe Chris at Colonial or Challenger, they'd say, oh, he's focused. He goes in, it's like you go into this zone, and it becomes very clear in the inside of that zone. You know exactly what to do. It's like you are in another world. But, you know, outside that zone, suffer. And you just don't spend enough time, and you become disproportionate in the way you allocate time to things. And I felt after Challenger, after being in Challenger, my second sort of quite big role, it was a big public company, it was within the top 100 companies for a short period, I thought, I don't want to go into that zone again. I enjoyed it in there, but I don't think it's fair on me as an individual to grow, to be in that zone for too long, and certainly I don't think it's fair on people around me, not just family, you know, friends and the like too. So very important to sort of understand your character, and when you get absorbed in, I think, sort of accountants, actuaries, sort of lawyers, they're often all in that their cousin groups, they do get very absorbed in what they do. Just be careful that you know when you're inside, and sometimes, you know, have a good look outside.
Great, thanks. Well, if everyone could just give both Jenna a fantastic round of applause.